old rhymes for new, Shakespeare's poems in original pronunciation. Before I introduce our guests, one huge thank you to the Arts Council for supporting the Ledbury Festival. It's vital to the festival. We're hugely grateful. Now, my pleasure and honor, I must say, to introduce our guests for this morning, David Crystal and Ben Crystal. I'll tell you just a little bit about them. They're here today, okay, to explain and perform Shakespeare's poetry in the original pronunciation. While the Crystals collaborate on many projects, such as this one, they also have their own individual careers and interests. David is a linguist, a writer, editor, lecturer, and broadcaster. He's honorary professor of linguistics at University of Bangor. Over the past 10 years, he's worked with various theater companies, introducing them to the original pronunciation with Shakespeare's works and other writers of that time. He was Master of Pronunciation at the Globe Theatre in 2004 and 5. He was also Sam Wanamaker Fellow at the Globe in 2003. He's authored, co-authored, or edited over 120 books, some of which are back there. One of his most recent works is the Oxford Dictionary of Original Shakespearean Pronunciation, which was published this year, as you might imagine. And that is on sale back there, among many others. Ben, equally busy man. Oh, yes, he's the...
I haven't written 120 books.
He's the son. Ben is an actor, a writer, and a producer. He's best known for performing Shakespeare in original pronunciation. He has co-authored several books on Shakespeare with his father, David. His first solo book, this is a wonderful title, Shakespeare on Toast, Getting a Taste for the Bard, was shortlisted for the 2010 Educational Writer of the Year Award. He is also Artistic Director of Passion in Practice and its Shakespearean Ensemble. This group's performed stage readings and full productions of Shakespeare's works at various venues, including the Wanamaker Playhouse and the Globe Theatre. As an actor, among many other roles, he has performed Hamlet in original pronunciation. I think you'll agree we're most fortunate to have such eminent gentlemen with us here today. Would you join me, please, in welcoming them, Ben and David Crystal?
Well, thanks very much. It's a delight. It's a delight to be here. The dog has a character role to play in a little while. Oh, well, it's a delight to be, well, for me, back in Ledbury again. I was here about 15 years ago, just after the festival started, and it's lovely to be back. This is Ben's first time. And okay, so we're going to start off with a little bit of OP, as we call it, OP. OP.
You said you were just going to let it speak for itself.
Yeah, go on, speak. I blame the parents.
Speak like I'm a white. I am, actually.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou'rt more lovely and more temperate. Rough wines do shake the darling buds of July. And summer's lace hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed. And every fair from fair sometime declines by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest. Nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe, or eyes can say, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
Now, when people hear OP for the first time, everybody says, we speak like that where I come from. And isn't it the truth here in Herefordshire? Yeah, I mean, there are echoes of old Herefordshire accents in that. I mean, many people from here down south through Gloucestershire into the West Country, the first thing they hear, of course, is the R pronounced after the vowels, you know, heart and car and what else did you have in that poem?
Summer.
Or summer, that sort of thing. And they notice that. And, of course, in Shakespeare's time, R was always pronounced after vowels, regardless of which part of the country you came to. I mean, those of you who, of course, have encountered, as you always do on the BBC and elsewhere, the R-less accent of the southeast, the accent of the Queen, the BBC, and so on, which is car and heart and all that, and summer. No, car and heart and summer. That accent, that southeast accent, is a very recent accent in the history of English. It only develops around about the year 1800. In Shakespeare's time, there was no such thing, and we'll talk a bit more about that later. So the R is one of the things. And how do I know there's an R there? I'll tell you about that in just a little while. But it's not that when I say everybody recognises the accent, it's because there are echoes of their own modern accent in the OP. It's because OP is the ancestor accent of many modern accents. Most of them, in fact. And, of course, not just in this country. It travelled across, the accent of Shakespeare's time travelled across to America on the Mayflower. And that's why American English largely has an R after the vowel. It came over from here.
I love the way that you described that, you know. When you say that it came over on the Mayflower, it's sort of like they were like, right, toothbrush, check, shoes, check. Got your accent? Yep, got the accent. Okay, let's go. Let's conquer the world.
Oh, yes. But why I say everybody recognises it, regardless of where they're from, if we analyse what Ben just did a few moments ago, you'll hear, for example, words like stage, which was stage, and today was today. I mean, in modern English, it's A, isn't it? Today, stage. Today and stage. Well, you don't say that round here, do you? No. Where do they say stage and today?
Up north, huh?
Lancashire, Yorkshire, isn't it? So that's an echo for them up there. And then, not ill, but oh, can I compare thee, or something like that, you know, or this oh sound. In modern English, it's oh, as in no and go and so. In Shakespeare, it's oh and go and so. Now, where do you hear that? You see, where would you hear somebody saying oh? Oh, well then, right. You're not so far away going in that direction, is it?
Where would you hear nater?
Now, nowhere. You see, this is the Shakespeare accent has features which no modern accent has. All modern accents say things like nature, with a ch in the middle. But in Shakespeare's time, it was nater, with a t. The ch hadn't come in. Or another example like that, you had complexion, didn't you, for complexion. Complexion, musician, information, conversation. Shakespeare's time, complexion, information, conversation, musician. Still occasionally heard today, O Lord, grant us thy salvation. Often in the evensong that you hear. And so, but most regional accents have dropped that. To take another example of an old feature, that's heard today, a word like house today, house and mouth, ow, the ow sound. It has a central start, house and mouth, house, house, house. Now, some regional accents in this country do that, but the one that has travelled is to Canada, and that is Canadian English, house and hout, out. That's how they speak over there, and there are Australian features in it. Shakespeare doesn't say yet, he says yit, 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 yit. That's straight out of Crocodile Dundee, really. You know. So the OP accent is an amalgam of many features of different kinds of accent that today we still hear examples of. But no modern accent has this particular combination that you heard a few seconds ago, and you'll hear again now.
My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. Carol is far more red than her lips red. If snow be white, why, then her breasts be dun. If hairs be wires, black wires grow on her head. I've seen roses damasked, red and white, but no such roses see I in her cheeks. And in some perfumes is there more delight than in the breath that from my mistress reeks. I love to hear her speak, yet well I know that music hath a far more pleasing sound. I grant I never saw a goddess go. My mistress, when she walks, treads on the ground. Yet, by heaven, I think my love as rare as any she belied with false compare.
Lovely. Yes, now here's some more features there from Annie, not any, Annie. False, not false, false. Did you hear noten at the beginning for nothing? Noten, noten. That's still used today. Have you got something? I've got nothing, nothing. You know, people still do that. They drop the T, as it were, drop the TH and put a T in place.
Well, it reminds me, though, there's a gentleman here that came to see. I directed a production of Much Ado a couple of years ago, and Dad tells me that it would have been pronounced Much Ado About Norton, which is a pun for Much Ado About Noting, eavesdropping, which is really important in that play.
Yeah, they're always eavesdropping in that play, aren't they? So a few more features there. And did you notice the huh sound? Why? What were the huh words in there?
It was really interesting because it made one of the lines quite hard to read. If snow be white, why then her breasts are done? Becomes if snow be white, why then her breasts are done?
Why, yeah, that huh.
To aspirate.
Yeah, in Shakespeare's time, Wales, the country, and Wales, the animal, were pronounced differently. Today in southeast England, of course, it's Wales and Wales. You can't tell the difference. Well, I think that's terrible. I mean, you've got to distinguish good footballers, haven't you, really, from...
To be fair, even if you were to give a whale a hat and a scarf and a football flag and a T-shirt, you'd probably still spot it.
You probably would, actually. Yeah, absolutely. So the first question that comes into people's heads, so not so much a question as a reaction, is you know, we speak like that where I come from. The first question that comes into your minds, and probably in all your minds now, is how do you know? You know, how do you do this? How do you reconstruct an earlier accent like this in the days before recorded sound? Well, what you do is you look for the evidence. There are four kinds of evidence that you look for. The first kind are the rhymes. The rhymes that don't work in modern English that must have worked in Shakespeare's time, otherwise Shakespeare's a lousy poet.
If he this be error and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved.
Yeah. Proved and loved. He does that a lot. He rhymes love with prove, love with move, and so on. Now, what's going on here? You can't say that these are I rhymes, visual rhymes, printer's rhymes, as they're often called, half rhymes, because that, as a poetic tradition, didn't develop in English until, the 18th century, really. So at the time, there's only two alternatives. One is, everybody was auditory effect in Shakespeare's day. Only two alternatives. One is that he didn't know how to rhyme, which I think we rule out. And the other is that the pronunciation has changed. And that, of course, is the solution. Yes. Now, which was it? Was it prove and louve, or was it prove and love? Well, we can rule out prove and louve, can't we, Ben?
Absolutely. We know, like we've done the research, we've looked at all the facts, we know that the only person to ever have rhymed, well, to have elongated that vowel of love to louve was Elvis Presley.
Yeah, so it wasn't that. No, we know it was prove and love. And how do I know that? Now we go to the second kind of evidence, and that is that people actually wrote books at the time in the 16th century describing English pronunciation. You see, it was a century of spelling reform. You know English spelling. It is not easy, and they had already noticed this by the 16th century. And people were starting to try and reform English spelling. They didn't succeed very much, but they were trying. And in order to reform spelling, you have to know how words are pronounced. And so they wrote books about pronunciation, telling you, but this word rhymes with this. This word does not rhyme with this. This word has a long vowel. This word has a short vowel, and so on. So how do I know that it's pruv? Because they say so. Ben Jonson, the dramatist, who you know as a dramatist, also... Not many people nowadays.
Not a lot of people nowadays.
Not a lot of people. Wrote an English grammar. And at the front of the English grammar, there he goes through every letter of the alphabet. And when he gets the letter O, this is what he says. We pronounce this letter O short, as in the following words. And he says, glove, love, brother, pruv. Thank you, Ben. That's I'm talking about Ben Jonson, not thanking you.
That's
exactly what I wanted to know. And that's the kind of evidence that allows us to sense rhymes, use rhymes as one of the evidences, one of the pieces of evidence for reconstructing OP. I'll tell you more about the other pieces of evidence in a minute. Have you got a rhyming example there, Ben?
We've got that one. We just...
Could you go over it again, the last, just to get the rhyme?
Oh, set. Sure. So if this be error and upon me proved,
yeah.
I never written a...
No, we never learned. Yeah. Well, I'll do another one.
I was going to read the sonnet.
Oh, yeah, you go ahead. Yeah.
You know, to get the full auditory effect.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. You're good at reading, are you? You know how to do that?
Actually, you know, I've just learnt them all, and I'm just pretending... This isn't a book of sonnets. This is just the roadmap to Ledbury.
Well, he's good at acting reading, isn't he? Yeah.
Pick a number from 115 to 117. Any number.
All right. 116.
Sold. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds or bends with a remover to remove. It is an ever-fixed mark, which looks on tempests, but is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fall, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brave oars and wakes, bears it out into the edge of dumb. This be error, and upon me proved. I never read, nor no man e'er loved.
Proved and loved coming at the end there. And lots of other interesting features in that poem, Mariage, for instance, at the beginning.
We've got the O.
What else you got there?
We've got the O, no. O, which you mentioned, or alters.
The O, yeah.
Alters. Remover to remove.
And remover to remove. Yeah.
Oh, did you want to mention the pun here?
Well, this is the second kind of evidence now. Rhymes are the first, puns are the second. In other words, Shakespeare makes a pun, and it doesn't work in modern English because the pronunciation has changed. And so there are all kinds of raunchy puns in Shakespeare, many of which don't come across in a modern production because people don't recognize the word in the modern pronunciation.
I think that was the biggest success. I mean, Dad did two original pronunciation explorations at the Globe 10 years ago. One was Romeo and Juliet, and the second one was Troilus and Cressida. And I think one of the most effective puns that I'd heard about that no one had heard about before was from Troilus.
From Troilus. If you know the play, it's about the Greek-Trojan Wars, and there's a character in there, a big, lumpish, brutish, rather thick character called Ajax. And people are always taking the mickey out of Ajax, especially Thersites, the camp follower who goes around following the army.
And at one point, important about stress that. The camp follower, not
the camp follower. Not a camp
follower. Not the camp follower.
No. Well, he might have been
He might have been both.
Yes.
Cooey! Where are the tents?
Look, you've woken
I'm woken the dog up. Come
you've
back
woken
here.
Edie up now. Oh,
so,
dear.
She hates it when I go off script. Sit down.
Oh, yes. So, anyway, at one point, Ulysses, one of the commanders, is telling everybody else, he's insulting Ajax, and he says at one point, "For whomsoever he be, whoever he thinks he is Ajax." And that's supposed to be an insult. For whomsoever he be, he is Ajax. That's like me saying, you know, for whomsoever he is, he's Ben. And is that an insult? How could that possibly be? Well, I suppose it could be. But, you know, why is it an insult? It's only an insult if you know, first of all, the fact that the name Ajax was pronounced in two ways, as Ajax and also Ajax. Ajax.
All about the stress.
And then you need to know, as I think a couple of you already have sensed, that the word Ajax, J-A-K-E-S, is an Elizabethan word for a toilet. Or a sort of sewer toilet. It's a very, very rude word. I mean, I don't suppose you use rude words here in Ledbury very much. But if I were to say shit house, it would be closer to the overall feeling of that word. So what he's saying, Thersites, is for whomsoever he be, he is a jex. You're a toilet. That's basically what he's saying. And it's a joke that would come across immediately to anybody, for example, from Ireland, because in Ireland, that's exactly what they say. You're going to the Jakes. You're going to the Jakes, Ted. Are you?
He keeps calling me by weird name. I'm not Ted. Ben, Dad.
Ben. Yeah, sorry.
Now, do you want to go and see the film, though?
Ah, yeah, true. That's another one. But hey, we'll come on to that in a second. That's a very good example. So, puns are the second kind of evidence, and in the poem you just heard, there is an interesting pun. The word hour in Shakespeare is pronounced or. Or. The word for a whore, a prostitute, is also or. So every time the word hour turns up, I mean, often it just means the time of day, of course, there's no pun intended at all. But sometimes you begin to wonder whether Shakespeare wasn't being a little bit naughty, and in this line...
Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks.
Alters not. Yeah, hours and weeks is the obvious reading, but is Shakespeare just sort of suggesting that...
Well, if it's a poem about love, about true love, about the testament of love lasting longer than than the eternity, than to past doom, then... I suppose love alters not with his brief hours and weeks. Love isn't just about the physical. Love is so much more than just the physical connection.
It's not just meeting up with a prostitute for a night, as it were.
Absolutely, which is quite romantic in a weird way, I suppose.
Yes. So that's an example. These puns turn up unexpectedly. The opening of Romeo and Juliet, for instance, the prologue at the beginning, from forth the fatal loins of these two foes, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life. In OP, from forth the fatal lines of these two foes, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life. Lines. Loins was pronounced lines. But the word for lines was also pronounced lines. So you've got a pun there between L-O-I-N-S, meaning sexual loins, and L-I-N-E-S, meaning genealogical lines. And it's a pun that only works in OP. It doesn't work in modern English, and no edition of Romeo and Juliet actually mentions it. So this is the sort of thing that OP can do. It can give you a fresh reading sometimes.
I loved, I've mentioned, I was lucky enough to play Hamlet once. I've also played Pericles, which is a beautiful play, a beautiful part. If you don't know it, it's a wonderful part of the canon, relatively unexplored over here. Although there's been about six productions in America recently. But anyway, in both plays, I got to say the word woman in Hamlet, almost pernicious woman, and in Pericles, when he's grieving over his dead wife and orders the nurse to go look after the baby, says suddenly woman. And Dad told me that there's a possibility of saying woe man, a man full of woe, almost pernicious woe man.
It was a common pun. It was a kind of everyday joke in Elizabethan times. A woman is a woe man. You know, that it was not a very politically correct joke these days, but in those days, yes. And so the option is there for an actor to introduce that pronunciation and give a fresh reading to the line.
I think, like, certainly for me, having watched Dad work on this and then tried to take this work on and explore it with my own company, it's the options that it provides you as an actor. They're so refreshing, illuminating, exciting to be sort of feeling like you're brushing dust off a new area of Shakespeare, which is so unheard of these days. You wanted me to do this. It says here, do some acting. No.
Oh, in a minute. Oh, okay. Yeah, you have to keep him.
I'm just reading this.
Yeah, you know. Oh, dear. He,
is it now? Can I do it now?
No, not yet. Go away. No, we've got to have a bit more intellectual stuff first. Yeah.
To be
no.
On
a... Your turn will come. Oh, I don't know. I blame the parents. We needed to have put the electrodes in a different place when he was little. That's what we should have done.
They put it on the quill. That was the problem.
Oh, really?
Right. Not a euphemism.
Yeah. Okay, now the third kind of evidence is the evidence of the spellings. Spelling wasn't standardised in 1600. Correct spelling is crucial these days. We all have to learn to spell, and we get taught it in school. And if we make spelling mistakes, we can get into trouble, even though lots of people still do. But the point is that in 1600, such notions of correct spelling didn't exist. And so people wrote more or less as they pronounced. And so you can use the spelling sometimes as a clue to how the word was pronounced at the time. And a good example comes from Romeo and Juliet. You remember the place where Romeo and Mercutio are having a bit of a row, and one says, "I had a dream last night," and the other one says, "Yes, so did I. Tell me yours." "No, you tell me yours first." And Mercutio tells the story of Queen Mab, the fairy that goes through your minds when you're asleep and makes you dream in certain ways. And halfway down the speech, she's described as going around in a chariot, pulled by a grasshopper, and she controls the grasshopper with a whip which has a lash of
film,
F-I-L-M in modern spelling. But in the first folio and in the quarto edition of the play, it's spelt like this. Listen carefully. P-H-I-L-O-M-E. Philom. Like Philomena, indeed. Philom. Now, saying it quickly, Philom. Philom. A lash of Philom. Which is how it would have been pronounced then. And it's one of those words that has stayed in modern pronunciation in which accent? Who says Philom? The Irish do. Are you going to the Philom, Ben?
I will, Ted.
So, you know, spelling is a good guide as well. And in the dictionary that I'll tell you about in a little while, I include all the spelling evidence as well as all the rhyming evidence so that you can work out for yourselves how you reach a particular conclusion about a particular way a word is pronounced. So that's the third kind of evidence. And that, along with the fourth kind, which I mentioned already, the Ben Jonson type of thing, the books that were written and the comments that were made, put all that together and you get the results that you've been hearing so far this morning. Now, it's not 100% perfect. It's not... one will never know everything.
Failed.
I know.
120 books, you still can't get it right.
I know.
What's that about?
Yeah, but it's 90% pretty perfect.
90%.
You know, it's as good as we can get based on the evidence. There are always occasionally some words that you come across and there's no evidence at all. Just like, imagine somebody in 400 years' time describing today's pronunciation and all the variations that there are. So what do you say around here? Do you eat scones or scones? Oh, wow. Is it a garage or a garage? You know, do you say often or often? Do you say schedule or schedule?
And I'm still trying to work out if I drove past Shrewsbury or Shrewsbury yesterday.
Well, yeah. And that's an interesting one, actually, because these days most people in Shrewsbury say Shrewsbury, but the older pronunciation is Shrewsbury, and it's the taming of the shrew, not the taming of the shrew, you know, in Shakespeare's time. And the evidence for that are certain rhymes. The last couplet in the play rhymes shrew with go or something. Like, yeah, whatever it is. And Shrewsbury, then, if you're being really classical, dear boy.
Oh, I tried to be
funny. Yeah, yeah. So, there we are. The four kinds of evidence. That's how we know. Let's have another example, Ben.
Oh, sure, yeah, absolutely. Not marble, nor the gilded monuments of princes shall outlive this powerful rhyme, but you shall shine more bright in these contents than unswept stone besmeared with sluttish time. When wastful war shall statues overturn and broils root out the work of masonry, not Mars his sword nor war's quick fire shall burn the living record of your memory. Gainst death and all oblivious enmity shall you pace forth, your praise shall still find room, e'en in the eyes of all posterity that wear this world out to the end in dumb. So, till the judgment that yourself arise, you live in this and dwell in lovers' eyes.
Now, that's a really interesting one. Because of the assonances that emerge. You know, assonance is when vowels reflect each other in a particular line. They echo each other. Now, in modern English, Ben...
Yep.
May I?
No.
Can I? It's all right. I'll show it. When wasteful war shall statues overturn, wasteful with an A, war with an OR, overturn with an ER, right? Uninteresting. When wastful war shall statues overturn, it's R, R, R throughout the line. And then, nor Mars his sword, nor war's quick fire shall burn. This R suddenly starts coming out over and over and over. Never back.
Thank you, Father.
And this produces a very different auditory effect. You know, if we're listening to poetry, as you've been doing all week, I mean, what are you listening to? What is it there for? Coleridge gives us the answer. Coleridge says in his introduction about poetry, poetry is there to give us pleasure, over and above meaning. But he emphasizes this point. It's the sound, the effect that we enjoy so much. And that's one of the big things in listening to OP. It's not so much the fact that you get new puns and new meanings and so on. You do sometimes, as I said before. But suddenly, rhymes work that didn't work before. And this makes us feel good. And then these assonances come out. And that makes us feel, oh, that was really a pleasant thing to listen to. And war is one of the best examples.
Ah.
Because normally, of course, in modern English, it's war. War. Now... there's a famous line that you used to do, Ben. Uh-huh. What was it?
It's Julius Caesar. Well, it's a famous line in the canon. Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. Hello, I'm a dog of war. Pleased to meet you. Enchanted. We're going to have some war. Then tea. Then a bit more war. It's all very jolly. It doesn't sound like war. I mean, war is, you know, when you hear it and receive pronunciation, war doesn't sound particularly gritty, warring. It doesn't have the colour of the word war, does it?
Mm,
it's
right.
Definitely not, you know, whereas in OP, it's, cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. I'm a dog of war. And you're like, whoa, okay. We surrender.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very good example of how the effect can alter dramatically by the new sound. I mean, another example, I remember when we were doing Henry V at the Globe last year, the famous speech before Harfleur, The one that ends with St. George. For Cray
Havoc. And
God for Harry. God for Harry, England and St. George. Yeah.
And upon this charge, cry God for Harry, England and St. George.
Yeah, it's got to be charge and jarge, and then it works. Not charge and George. You know, I mean,
upon this charge, cry God for Harry, England and St. George.
St. George. It doesn't work, does it, really? But anyway, that's another example. So, this leads us to a reconstruction, which the...
Oh, that's what I wanted to say.
What?
In defence, I'm going to defend you, Father.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, no, I know it's a first. But the 90% thing, because I think, you know, you want, on the one side, you could think, oh, well, that's a shame that we can't get it, you know, perfect, whatever that means. Certainly no one strives for authentic with original practices of Shakespeare. You know, the Shakespeare's Globe Theatre doesn't strive to be authentic reconstruction, but a good enough one to give you an idea of what it must have been like. You can't be authentic with helicopters and mobile phones and you know, life of the 21st century world. But we like, in the company, we like the fact that with being 90% right, then it allows each of my actors to retain the essence of their own accent. So all of my actors, when they were speaking in original pronunciation, we all sound 90% the same, but we all cling on to 10% of our own uniqueness, our own vocal fingerprint, if you will. And so we sound the same, but we also sound a little
and
bit
different. And that's important. That's very important. What you're hearing today is original pronunciation as produced by me or produced by Ben with our distinctive background accents. Just like in this room now, there are 100 people or so, and each of us has got an individual voice, and we'd recognise it and perhaps say, you know, there are even people here from Missouri, so I'm told. All these different accents are... We all speak the same language. We're all speaking modern English, but in 100 different, slightly different accents, and it was the same in Shakespeare's time. So we know where some of these actors on Shakespeare's stage came from. They came from all over the place. They came from the north, they came from Worcestershire, they came from the West Country, came from London, Scotland, and so on. So there would have been different accents on the stage. And that's the thing you must remember. OP isn't a single accent. It's a sound system on top of which, as Ben was saying, you superimpose your own natural accent and it comes out in all sorts of different ways. And this is one of the reasons why it's taken off so much. You see, it started in 2004 when Shakespeare's Globe decided to do Romeo and Juliet in original pronunciation. It was a bit of an experiment. Nobody had done it before, but it was very successful. So we did another play the next year, Troilus and Cressida, as you've heard. And in the audience of that play, there were people from all over the world and interested in different things. There were early music people there. They were interested in hearing Dowland and Byrd and other composers of the 1600s, Purcell later, of course, where also the rhymes don't work, you see, very often, and they wanted to hear them in original pronunciation. So they went off on a certain tangent. Then there were the people interested in heritage. You know, you go to Stratford or in the United States, go to Plymouth Plantation, where people are dressed up in an oldie-worldy sort of way, and they're speaking modern English. No, they want to speak authentically as much as they can in the older style, and so they were interested in it. A few years ago, there was the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, wasn't it? 2011. People wanted to hear how the Bible would sound in original pronunciation. 1611, after all, it would have been that sort of accent, you see. And then across the pond, where some people have come from, the Americans fell in love with it. Now, why? Most of the productions that have been done in OP have been done in the States. Ben's Hamlet that he was telling you about was done in, or that you mentioned earlier on, was done in Reno in Nevada.
I don't understand it either, but it's fine.
Yes, the gambling capital of the world. There's been an As You Like It over there, a Julius Caesar over there, a Midsummer Night's Dream over there, and so on and so forth. About 15 or 16 plays have been done in OP, mainly in America. Why in America? Because Americans, we've both found this, haven't we, talking to American actors and directors, they don't feel they own Shakespeare. Isn't that so, Ben?
It's an ownership issue. In all my travels of Shakespeare, generally, I mean, let's take school children, for example. I do a lot of work in schools all around the world. And generally, the school children in this country feel that Shakespeare is a bit of an onus, a burden, unfortunately, which is why I work very hard to counteract that, having experienced it myself. However, people across from these shores adore Shakespeare, but they don't feel that they have quite the permission to do it because they don't feel that they sound right. And this, wonderfully, is the key to allowing them to sound perfectly fine. I mean, In our own company, we've had Caribbean actors bringing a Caribbean flavour to original pronunciation, Austrian actors, Dutch actors, Canadian, Australia, from all over.
Americans typically say, we can't do Shakespeare because we don't sound like Olivier, you see, or something like that. And when you point out that actually Shakespeare himself didn't sound like Olivier, but sounded more like, how he sounds, you've just been doing it. And then they say, but that's closer to American English, with the R's and everything. And suddenly a kind of light dawns, and they become so happy, and they start doing OP productions. So most of them have been done in the States. So we'll end in 5 minutes and have a Q&A around the room. But one other thing I wanted to tell you was that it isn't just the individual words that are important. It's also the way the words are put together into sentences, into rhythms. That's important as well. Do you remember Hamlet talking to the players and says, "Speak the speech as I pronounced it to you, trippingly upon the tongue"? What does that mean? He says, don't mouth it like the town criers do. Well, this means presumably that we should not be speaking like this all the time. But we should be speaking like this all the time. And so when we did Romeo, this is the interesting point, at the Globe in 2004, remember I told you it was done as an experiment. That meant just a weekend in the middle of a run where the actors were doing it in modern English. So the poor actors had to learn the play twice, once in modern pronunciation and once in OP. Anyway, here's the thing. They filmed both. They filmed the modern English version and the OP version. The OP version was 10 minutes shorter than the modern English version. And the reason is because of the speed at which they did the lines. So here's Romeo looking up at Juliet and saying in modern English, "Oh, it is my lady. Oh, it is my love. Oh, that she knew she were." 6 seconds or so. In OP, "Oh, it is my lady. Oh, it is my love. Oh, that she knew she were." 4 seconds. Now, add that up throughout the play, and you get 10 minutes difference at the end of the play. So that's an important feature. So although in the poems there isn't, as it were, so much drama as such, although some of the poems are quite dramatic, we thought we'd end with something from one of the plays where you do get a greater sense of the rhythm and the speed, and the OP fits together into, let's choose a completely unknown speech. You've got the dog here, something from Two Gentlemen of Verona.
She hasn't learned that one.
She hasn't learned it. Oh, damn. Have you got any speech in mind, Ben?
Oh, you want it? I thought you wanted. You didn't want Sonnet 40.
Well, you can do that as well if you like.
How long have you got?
Well, we've only got a couple of minutes, so.
You wanted that? All right. Yeah. Okay. All right.
So, all right. All right then. All right, if you insist. Not supposed to be.
That's good. The introduction you're giving me.
In the middle of the play called Hamlet. Hamlet comes to the front and does a soliloquy that...
I'm going to introduce it. So when I got to perform Hamlet, two things, I suppose. In harmony with speaking in original pronunciation, I tend to work in original practices as much as possible. So, trying to learn from the way that the Elizabethans worked. So I use cue scripts. Actors would only have had their lines and their cue words, not the whole script. And to get my cue script, I go back to the first folio. And a lot of the so-called inconsistencies in the first folio are edited out in modern editions of Shakespeare. So there's a lot of capitalized words that seem quite random in the first folio. But I was taught that they were clues from Shakespeare, or the printers, to the actors to pick out important words. And I'd noticed that in this previous speech of Hamlet's, Rogue and Peasant Slave, he asks the audience if they think him a coward. And it's coward has got a capital C in the folio. And in original pronunciation, my father told me, coward is pronounced cord. Am I a cord? Asks Hamlet to the audience. Because, you know, he doesn't know if the audience thinks him a coward for not having acted yet, for not having done anything about what the ghost has told him about his father's death. And then he comes back on a few moments later and delivers the most famous speech in English theatrical history, which most people think is a speech about Hamlet trying to decide whether or not he's going to kill himself. But a lot of people have trouble with the placing of the speech there because he's just at the end of Rogue and Peasant Slave said, I'm going to put a play on that looks like the murder of my father before mine uncle. If my uncle shows a terrible reaction, I know he's guilty. The play's the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king. And then he comes back on a few moments later and apparently goes, oh God, I think I'm going to kill myself. I think that doesn't make sense. And I noticed that at the end of this speech, that word coward with a capital C, cord, comes up again. And it really struck a chord with me. Because I thought, well, in Elizabethan times, a speech like this was an opportunity for the character to come and ask his friends, the audience, a question. What is this question he's asking? And I thought, oh, maybe he's thought about the fact that he hears the audience shout at him, and he hears the audience being disappointed with his lack of action. And he comes back and says, no, you have to understand. I went to university in Wittenberg, where Luther nailed his things to the door, right? I don't necessarily believe in the ideas of heaven and hell and certainly limbo and that kind of obfuscation of religions at the beginning with the ghost. And I'm not sure whether he's telling me the truth or whether he's the devil in disguise. And if there is such a thing as heaven or hell and I kill my uncle and he's innocent, do I go there? And if you thought about life and death the way that I think about life and death, maybe you would consider yourselves cordly. To be or not to be? That is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against the sair troubles and by opposing end them. To die, to slate, no more. And by a slate to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. Is a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep perchance to dream, aye, there's the rub, for in that sleep of death, what dreams may come, when we have shuffled off this mortal coil, must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity a so long life, for who would bear the whips and scorns of time? The oppressor's wrong? The poor man's contumely, the pangs of disprized love, the law's delay, the insolence of office, or the spurns that patient merit of the unworthy takes, when he himself might his coitus make with a bare bodkin? Who would these fardels bear to grunt and sweat under a weary life, but that the threat of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns, puzzles the will, and makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others that we know not of. Thus, conscience doth make cords of us all. And thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought and enterprises of great pith and moment with this regard. Their currents turn awry and loose the name of action. Soft, you know, the Ferophilia.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Well, thank you, Edie thinks the show's over. Not quite, Edie. We've got another, 10 minutes, 12 minutes or so. So please, if you've got a question, either for me or for Ben, just wave and we'll try and answer it.
Immediately.
So,
lady at the back.
Lady at the back.
What, if the equivalent then in the 16th century of RP, yeah? So the Queen would speak that way.
Ah. Right.
And I'm thinking about regional.
Yes, I can see your point. Yes, what about RP? There was no RP in Shakespeare's day. So there was no posh accent, if you like, in Shakespeare's day. The only way you could show you were posh, as it were, would be to show that you were educated, which meant you knew how to read and write, and that means you'd put your H's in, for example, and say households rather than households and things like that. But the nobility would speak in exactly this way, depending on where they came from. So we know, for example, that Walter Raleigh and Francis Drake came from Devon. They spoke, the commentators say, they spoke in a Devonshire way. It would have been Devonshire on top of what you've just been hearing. We don't know exactly how Queen Elizabeth spoke, unfortunately. Nobody actually made any remarks, so that's unclear. But in
firmly.
Yes.
With authority.
With authority. But in 1603, we do know how the court spoke, because what happened in 1603? King James comes down from Scotland, and suddenly the entire court is speaking in a Scottish accent. And everybody is commenting on this, though very respectfully, of course. And there is actually a play which takes the mickey out of the Scottish accent, and it was banned a couple of years later. So, the accents were all very regional, very down-to-earth, nothing posh, except that if you were educated, as most of them were, they would speak perhaps in a slightly more literal way, putting their H's in, putting their G's in, not saying running, but running, you know, things like this. Be the only way you could tell.
But not as far as Holofernes.
But not as far as Holofernes in Love's Labour's Lost, who insists on pronouncing every letter in the word and says he's horrified when Don Amado says the word debt as debt, whereas everybody knows it should be debt. You see, he talks like that. You know, this was a problem when we did Romeo at the Globe. One of my very first experiences of working with an acting company was when the prince, who was, we were in the room and we were practising the OP, and the prince said exactly what's behind your thought there. He says, you know, I'm a prince. How do I show I'm a prince if I can't speak posh? You see? And the director, Tim Carroll, looked him straight in the eye and said, act. So, and of course, you can be a prince without RP, can't you, Benjamin?
Absolutely. You know, how can you tell? Because we don't use costumes particularly either, and Shakespeare's company didn't particularly much. How can you tell the king from the commoner? Well, you know, the commoner falls to his knees when the king walks in, and the king gets a crown.
Yes.
Done.
Absolutely. So, thank you for that,
m'lady.
What brought about the RP being sort of standing?
RP develops at the end of the 18th century. The 18th century is the century of manners, of correctness, of politeness. It's a century where the old division between upper class and lower class was breaking down because of the arrival of the new middle, what, class or class? What are they going to do, these people who built the railways, built the roads, built the textile machines and so on? They are working class background, but suddenly they're rich and they find themselves mixing with the upper classes and they don't know how to speak. And so they go to elocution lessons. This is the growth of the elocution movement at the end of the 18th century. And you could join in London, for example, a society called the Society for the Protection of the Letter H. And what you would do was you'd go and meet with your friends and you'd practice, not doing what those horrible Cockney people do. Because a Cockney person says then, as today, I hurt my harm. I hurt, dropping the H, my harm, putting the H in. Well, we're not going to be like that, you see. And slowly this received pronunciation grows as an attempt to differentiate themselves from everybody else. So if most people around the country pronounce an R after the vowel, we will not, you see. We'll show we're different. So you say car, we will say car. And that's the first accent in Britain to really drop its R's like that. So it became a kind of class accent around about 1800.
Is there a question in the gallery? The lights are very bright. I can't quite see you all.
No?
Great, okay.
Does this come up then in the Midsummer's Night's Dream when mechanicals are performing to the court, that there's this difference in accent and language?
Yes, there are a number of puns in that scene at the end, like ace and the word ace, meaning playing card, was pronounced ass. And so you get that pun with being an ass towards the end. So there are a number of nice, interesting puns that come up towards the end. Now, what accent you put the mechanicals in is entirely up to you. When Greg Doran did The Dream at Stratford back in the late 90s, he made all the mechanicals speak in a strong Birmingham accent. And, of course, people started to laugh immediately just because they were speaking in a Birmingham accent, and I didn't really like that so much. But you can give them any accent you like. It doesn't matter, in a way. You can still maintain the difference and give them a strong regional tinge rather than a less regional tinge. Or you can give them exactly the same accent as the nobility has. The interesting thing, when we did Dream in Kansas in OP, a lot of the discussion was, what do we do with the initial H? You see, because it's the difference between, you know, house and ouse. Now, if you can know how to read, you'll almost certainly say house. So one expects that Theseus and Demetrius and Lysander and the others would have been literate, and so they would keep their H's, we decided. The mechanicals, on the other hand, probably, well, they know how to read because they're reading their scripts, but presumably they are less educated, and so we said, well, they will drop their H's. Okay, so now, question now is, what do we do with the fairies? What do we do with Puck and the others? Are Titania and Oberon upper-class fairies, and so they keep their H's? Or are they lower class fairies, down to earth and so on, and they drop their H's? And now it's your decision. You're the director, Ben. What are you going to do, you know?
Well, now what I do, before I wouldn't know, but now I would use this. Available at all good bookshops.
Yeah. But what we did, actually, in the end, was we had the fairies. It's not my decision. This is the director's decision. He decided to have the fairies drop their H's for one reason, and that is, you remember at the scene where Puck is chasing Lysander and Demetrius through the forest and is calling out in their voices? Well, it meant that Puck could now copy Lysander and Demetrius's voices. Puck puts H's on for the first time and makes his accent different from what he would normally speak, which is H-less. And that same sort of thing happens at the end with the mechanicals. Remember this business about, I can say it in Erkley's vein, Bottom and the others. They seem to drop their H's, but when they're speaking in the play as Pyramus and Thisbe, then we had them put the H's back in and get them wrong every now and again. So it was a kind of linguistic joke. Now, did anybody notice in the audience, apart
one.
From me?
One.
Two. Yeah, well done.
By that clock, it looks like we've got...
Five minutes.
Yeah. Yes, madame, at the back.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm wondering if you think there were more accents in Britain in that time than there are now, or
That's difficult to say, because very few people described accents very much, though there was a little bit. But what we know is that the population of London and the country as a whole doubled. I remember after the Black Death, when the population halved virtually, and then suddenly immigration, you've probably heard about immigrants and things recently, but there was a huge immigration thing during the 16th century, including a lot of people from Europe as well as people moving from the north to the south. The population of London doubles in 50 years. And as a result, the number of accents and mixed accents must have been huge at the time. But, you know, there is an accent shift in this country today on average every 25 miles. You know here, you can tell somebody from that over that way or over that way. I did some accent research in Welshpool, which is not so far away, a few years ago for a television program. Don't know whether you know Welshpool is the main street, goes down like that. On the Welsh side of the street, they speak in a Welsh sort of way, and on the east side of the street, they speak like Herefordshire. You know, so, you know, if you hear somebody coming down the street and he says, heart, you know, he lives over there. And if he says heart, he lives over there, you know. So that's within a few yards of each other. So on average, about 25 miles is the average distance. So there's plenty of accents still around today. Even though some of the old accents have been dying out a bit, You know, you don't hear the old Herefordshire so much these days, perhaps, but you do hear modern Herefordshire in all sorts of ways. Mixed accents, people coming in from abroad, the local Chinese restaurant or Thai restaurant or Indian restaurant, and they're not speaking their classical accents. They've been pulled in the direction of our accents, and you're getting these mixed accents all the time now. And so I think there probably are just as many, but who's counting, you know? Well, it's 12 o'clock. One more?
One more.
Yeah.
You know the York Mystery Players?
Yes.
They've been doing those for years, haven't they? How are their accents?
Well, they've been doing it very much in a strongly Yorkshire sort of way, and they haven't been doing it in a kind of classical OP way because this OP thing is very, very recent. You know, it's only 10, 15 years old, and I would expect some of those people now to modify their pure Yorkshire with an OP and produce a kind of more authentic sound. I hope they will. I don't know whether they are. The problem is, if you do a play in a modern accent, the modern accent brings with it all the baggage of the modern accent. So when you hear modern Yorkshire, it sounds like, well, you know, Churchill on the telly, you know.
Monty Python.
Well, Monty Python or something like this. And you can't get rid of these associations sometimes. Whereas OP doesn't have that kind of baggage. So I think it'll be a plus for them if they do bring the Yorkshire on top of the OP. It'll certainly be a very interesting experiment.
Ladies and gentlemen, we do have to stop now, but joking aside, we will be at the back. We'll be signing books, and we're happy to take any more questions and chat with you all then. But thank you very much for having us. Thank you.